Hey yo, and here we go. It is a special interview episode of We Talk Comics. This is Keith, your regular host. I am joined by hosts emeritus Brett.
Hello.
And Mo.
Hi, I'll shut up now for a while.
It's a podcast first.
Mo is in an extension of the swear jar. Mo has to put a dollar in every time he asks a question. So he has to have, and no IOUs. That could be cash. We get to
split the money up at the end.
Yeah, we'll mail it to you.
It's in Canadian, so 90 cents every time he gets to ask a question.
It'll resemble a no prize.
And our guest for this interview episode, known in comic circles, primary and mostly. As the co-creator of characters such as The Punisher, Vance Astrovic, and I just got the page in front of me, Firestorm, of course. I know him, I always think of him first as the creator, co-creator of Steel, the Indestructible Man. We're joined by Jerry Conway.
Hi, guys. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. It is really a privilege to talk to you. I'm really excited about going into this. You also wrote a Justice League for 8 years?
Close to 10, I think. But there was a period when I was just starting on the series where I would do like 3 or 4 issues, and then 2 issues would be by somebody else and 3 or 4 issues. So as a straight run, about 8.5 years, and as a overall, I think about 10 years.
And
at one point, I'd written it the longest of anybody who'd written it. So, but then other people came along, you know. So they have a tendency to do that. Yeah. Who are they?
And
punk kids.
And creator of the cult classic Justice League Detroit era.
Yes.
And in that vibe and Vixen. Two characters that have returned quite recently and found their place.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. A lot of characters that were kind of tossed by the wayside in the 80s turned out to have fans among the kids who were actually reading the books, who then later went on and grew up and started writing and creating the books. And they brought back their favorite characters, which happened to be the characters that I had done in the 80s. So it's like, oh, that was cool. like gaining some cred, you know, in retrospect. So that's kind of fun.
Well, and one of those characters that has come and gone a few times, but keeps being revived because I think that a lot of the big creators right now are my age, so they grew up with these characters.
Right.
And one of those is Steel, the Indestructible Man.
Yes.
And that's actually the character that I said I want to talk to Jerry because of Steel, the Indestructible Man. I'll tell you why that character. When I was a kid, I got a lot of hand-me-down comics. There was a lot of Superman, a lot of Batman, a lot of Justice League. First Justice League story I read was also written by you. It was the Demons 3.
Oh, sure.
But the first time I saw Steel, the Indestructible Man, Don Heck art, it looked like nothing I had seen. And it was the first time that I had encountered something besides Super Friends characters.
Sure.
And I said, there, comics could be something besides Superman and Batman? This is crazy. Tell me a bit about the character.
It was designed, both Steel and Firestorm were designed to be let me say this in a way that doesn't make it sound like I was talking down in any way, but they were kind of designed to be retro Marvel style characters in the DC universe. I self-consciously and deliberately wanted to create something that would be reminiscent of the early 60s Marvel books, because I felt that was kind of where DC's books were situated at that particular moment in time in the mid 70s. They were just starting to embrace more character based storytelling and more extended serialized storytelling. And having worked at Marvel and having been a fan of Marvel books, and specifically being a fan of early 60s style Marvel books, I thought it would be kind of fun to try to sort of merge those two aesthetics, you know, with a character like Steel and a character like Firestorm. Firestorm being sort of a DC kind of version of Spider-Man in a sense, you know, a fun teenage superhero. And Steel being sort of a DC version of, you know, a Captain America type hero. Captain America / Iron Man sort of hero. And I try to tip my hand a bit in that by naming the characters' alter egos the way I did, as like Ronnie Raymond and Hank Hayward, you know, which are your classic Marvel-style alliterative names. And working with a guy like Don Heck, who, you know, very much encapsulated the Marvel style from the 60s, really sort of slammed that home, I thought.
And now this is the way that this period of DC is looked back upon is interesting. But these characters were created during the DC explosion, right?
Right. Which was followed almost immediately by the implosion.
and it's funny how like the implosion is what people think of, and there isn't a Wikipedia entry for the explosion, but there is for the implosion.
Well, the implosion was traumatic. You know, I mean, it was so abrupt and so insane, and unrelated to the actual sales of the books. It just happened, you know, because of corporate politics and corporate financing. But the explosion had been, which preceded that, was like a creative explosion that I think, you know, I mean, it gave rise to things like the New Teen Titans and other, you know, approaches to the characters that then went on, you know, and had resonance in the 80s and in the 90s, very much so.
Well, and it's interesting, like, I mean, looking at that period, there were so many new characters introduced in a very short period of time.
Yes.
And then so many of those characters are now, you know, again, because of the age of folks like Dan DiDio and Geoff Johns, they're, you know, ballpark my age. They grew up with those characters. They are all, as so many of those characters have appeared in the New 52 really prominently.
Yep.
And there were so many new characters created in that. How long had you been at DC when that explosion happened?
Well, I had started out at DC in the late 60s for a couple of years, working on some of their mystery and horror titles, you know, like The Witching Hour and House of Secrets and House of Mystery and so on. And then I'd gone over to Marvel for about 5 years, and I came back to DC for a year in 1975, 76. And we did a bunch of new books at that point, but nothing really breaking through. You know, it was more like me trying to introduce some Marvel style material to a culture that was kind of resistant to it. And then I went back to Marvel for about 6 months, maybe 9 months, and then came back to DC as Jeanette Kahn was starting to change the company. And it was at that point that we started to really begin to explode, you know, that the company started to bring out new material. That's when we did things like, I think that's when we did Hercules Unbound and, you know, obviously the Steel and Firestorm and the attempted Vixen book and some other things.
Yeah, and also around that, in that same as Prez, Shade the Changing Man,
right.
Claw the Unconquered, Black Lightning, was just so much new material being produced.
Yeah, yeah. It was really an opportunity. I mean, Jeanette came in and she literally did not know anything about the comic book business. She was a perfect tabula rasa, and that was great for the company because she had no preconceived notions about what would be good or bad. And her attitude was, let's try to be creative. And she encouraged a lot of that. There was a lot of stuff that didn't work, obviously. You know, I mean, I don't think Prez worked. But, you know, it was an attempt. It was a real attempt to try to do something. And all of that, you know, culminated in the implosion, which had more to do with, you know, technical and financial issues at Warner Brothers and, you know, with the parent company and with distribution and, you know, newsstands and all of these things that had nothing to do with the creative process. And I think that's why it had such an impact on the readership and on the creative staff, because it just didn't matter what we were doing. You know, it's just like it was just going to be wiped out. It didn't matter. You know, whether it was, you know, if you create a book and it doesn't sell, you say, okay, that didn't work. I guess that we didn't find an audience. But we weren't even given a chance to find an audience. So, you know, a lot of that material was just wiped out. And I think that's why we brought it back. You know, that's why I... To the extent that I started bringing back characters like Steel and Firestorm and Vixen through other means, you know, through guest appearances in Action Comics or Justice League or something like that, it was because I felt like they hadn't gotten their shot. And I think that was true for other creators who did that as well.
And now my brain's moving. What do you want
to spin on? I'm glad yours is, because it's 80 degrees where I'm sitting. You know?
Now, you were able to bring these characters back, primarily Justice League is where you were able to use them. And then one of the characters, I want to plug our sponsor Comicosity right now, because you did an interview talking about what would have been the first female character of color to have her own title.
Right, Vixen.
Vixen, which did not see print. When was Vixen's first print appearance after not coming out as a number one?
We had, I had her appear in a Superman story that I was doing, I think it was for Action Comics. It was either Action Comics or DC Presents. It was one of those two books. I'd previously done that with Firestorm, and it had been successful. And so Julie Schwartz was open to the idea of, you know, bringing one of these sort of missing heroes. You know? And my intention was to try to do the same thing that I did with Firestorm, which was, you know, sort of create a little campaign around this character so that maybe she'd get a backup feature, and then maybe that would lead to her having her own book again. As it turned out, the real opportunity came with putting her into JLA. So that was sort of how that worked out. But I didn't want to let her go because she just seemed like such a great idea for a character to me. And it was really a type of character that didn't have much, play at DC. Certainly, you know, I mean, they had Storm at Marvel, but not a lot of African-American female superheroines going around. So, you know, I figured I had a clear shot.
And was that kind of the environment at the time that it was, it's not, we need to make a diverse cast, we need to make we need younger characters. Was it more that, or was it more just ideas?
I think it was, I can't say that there was much thought process given to it. You know, there were some of us who were younger creators who wanted to do it because we saw it as an opportunity to differentiate our material. But we were all a bunch of, you know, white male guys from the city, basically. You know, there were a handful of maybe one or two African American artists in the business. There were no African American writers at that time, as far as I'm aware. And so you didn't have people with voices from outside of this particular kind of insular mindset, you know, that we represented. So if it was going to be done, it was going to be done by us. And some people were, I think, more aggressive about it than others. Some people had more sensitivity to it than others. I can't say that I was the most sensitive person. You know, I mean, my heart was in the right place, but, you know, my ability to write those kinds of characters with any real truth was kind of limited by my own socio-cultural background. But, you know, I certainly wanted to see it done. You know, and being in a position to try to get it done, that's what I tried to do.
And so I want to jump ahead a couple of years. You wrote Justice League through Crisis on Infinite Earths. Were you working on anything else at that time, writing anything else at that time?
Well, I was still doing Firestorm. I was writing about five or six titles a month for DC. I'm not sure the exact sequence of when I was writing different things, but I wrote Legion of Superheroes. I wrote Scalp Hunter for Weird Western. I wrote a series called Sun Devils with Dan Jurgens. Mm-hmm. Did Cinder and Ash was, I think, after that. But, you know, I was the jack of all trades for DC for about 10 years, where they knew that they could get reliable mid-range quality work for me. You know, sometimes better, sometimes not so good. But, you know, if they needed an issue of Superman Family, you know, written in 3 days, I could do it. You know, so that's what my role was. And there were the books that I really was passionate about, like Justice League or Firestorm, that I would put the majority of my energy into. And then there were books that I was less, you know, committed to and basically tried to do a professional job on. So I was doing a lot of work, probably much too much work. I ended up in the mid-80s having a major writer's block for about 2 years where I was barely able to function. So that did not end well. But while I was functioning, I was writing a lot. So I had my hand in a lot of pies at that time.
So we have the internet, we have Twitter and Facebook, and all these ways to connect directly with creators now in real time.
Right.
Now, you're the first creator we've been able to talk to that was actually writing at the time the crisis happened and the
right.
post-crisis reboot happened.
Yes.
What was that? Like, were you exposed to the fan reaction? What was the fan reaction like?
Well, I can't say that I had direct, you know, encounter with it because I didn't write the main titles that it affected. Justice League, it was affected to a degree, but not as much so as say Superman was, or Flash certainly was much more affected. I think Marv probably was the recipient of most of the fan reaction. And the general reaction was positive in a kind of qualified way. You know, it was sort of like people were excited by the idea that DC was shaking things up. They may have had issues with the individual choices that were made, you know, where they agreed or disagreed with, you know, why did you kill Supergirl? What happened to Wonder Girl? You know, stuff like that. But in general, it was a positive response. It just wasn't, you know, people who respond positively to things don't always make their voices heard. You know, it's sort of like they're happy, so they're not doing anything. They're just sort of going, oh, that's great, you know, and then they're fine. People who are upset tend to make their voices heard. So I think there was more, if we had letters, you know, if people wanted to sit down and write a letter, you probably would end up with, you know, a 3-to-1 ratio of negative to positive in letters. But you're not really, you can't really judge the impact of something based on that, because that's a kind of a self-selecting process. You know, you have to be upset enough or involved enough to actually write the letter. You know? And the people who are going to do that are the people who feel most passionately about it. I think the general response was positive, but the most vocal response was probably negative. And I was reading recently that the actual sales for DC was disappointing, in the sense of their overall line a year or two later had dropped in sales by 10 or 15%. So I'm not sure that it worked the way that DC wanted it to work, but I think it was very good for the company creatively.
Well, certainly, for me as a reader, I had read Marvel primarily up until that happened. And then it was that newness is what appealed to me, right, as, you know, 11, 12 year old, when that was happening. Was that I can be on the ground floor kind of thing.
Yeah. It gave you the sense that DC really cared, you know, I mean, that's the message of Crisis, was that we care enough about our books to put a lot of work into really making some substantial changes. Whether you agree with those changes or not, you have to be impressed by the fact that they thought about it, worked real hard at making it happen, and executed it. So that's a signal to you as a reader that we, the creators, are involved in this as much as you are. So it's a positive thing. You know, it's not. Again, you may not like the direction they go, but you got to admit that they were making an effort. So that was, I think, the most important aspect of it from a reader point of view.
And it was right around this time, as I said, you're doing Justice League, that Justice League Detroit happens.
Yes.
Now, having gone, you wrote the Big 7, Big 8 version of the Justice League for several years, and then you take this really strong turn. Yeah. With a whole new cast. How did that come to be?
Well, the truth is that the Justice League sales had been softening for several years. And at the same time, Teen Titans was doing really, really well. And people were always saying, why can't the Justice League, you know, people at the offices were saying, why can't the Justice League sell as well as Teen Titans? And my feeling at the time was that the reason that Titans was working and was successful was because Marv had those characters to himself. You know, he had that cast appearing only in Teen Titans, and he was able to write storylines that involved those characters in emotional and continuing stories that would be resolved in only Teen Titans. So if you cared about Starfire, you had to read Teen Titans, and so on. I, on the other hand, writing Justice League, I had characters who were appearing in other titles and could not have, you know, involved emotional storylines that played out solely in Justice League. So I was saying, well, I can't do what Titans is doing, because Batman has two titles where he appears, and Superman has two titles where he appears, and Wonder Woman has her own book, and, you know, so on and so forth. I can't do emotionally involving stories that affect these characters, you know, in really significant ways. So maybe what I need to do is change this grouping, you know, and make it characters who are only going to appear in Justice League, and who are going to have emotionally involving stories that just can only be told here in this book. So that was my initial argument with DC, or my initial case with DC. And then once they accepted that, then it became a question of, well, how will we redefine this book? And my thought at that time you know, was, well, let's go the exact opposite of what we've been doing, which is these kind of cosmic stories that, you know, involve the League defending the Earth from alien invasions and, you know, spectacular interdimensional warfare. And let's get it down to the ground level. Let's make this down to Earth. And it gave me the opportunity to bring in characters that I had created in other, you know, that were part of the DC implosion, like Vixen and Steel, and redefine the book, you know, to be more real world oriented, at least theoretically. You know, I don't think it worked out, but I don't think that it was because the idea itself was a bad one. Probably the execution, you know, wasn't up to snuff. And that probably had more to do with the fact that I was working on far too many projects, you know, to really give it the kind of storytelling strength that it deserved. You know, I've been writing the book for 10 years, so I was probably burned out.
So much of superhero comics now is based on, you know, 6-issue arcs, 12-issue arcs. Right. Some of the new 52 stuff is they planted stuff in the first issue that still hasn't played out. Like, they're long game on some of it. At that time, from kind of DC implosions, late 70s, early 80s, was it more compact? Did you still have kind of, this is where I want the character to be in a year?
I can't speak for, I think Marv Wolfman was very much a long game player. He had stories in mind for Titans that ran, you know, a year or more. But it wasn't designed the way that things are designed now, because what they're doing now with these 6-issue arcs is they're basically telling graphic novels. They're producing graphic novels that are broken up into 6 chapters. And that's for business and economic reasons, not so much creative reasons. And they're very valid reasons, because, you know, you've got to find ways to make this investment in this material pay off. And a monthly comic won't do it. You know, you have to publish them as trade paperbacks as well, in order for the economics to work out. But back then, we didn't have that, that constraint. So you told a story based on what impact you thought that particular story would have. Some stories were 1-issue stories. Some were two parters. Some seemed worth telling as 3 issues. It didn't require, you know, thinking about it in other terms. So once you start thinking about it as this has got to be a 6-issue story, that kind of changes and constrains the kinds of stories you're going to tell. It creates different opportunities, but it also creates limitations. Many times I would plant a story seed that I didn't know how I was going to turn it, how it was going to play out. And sometimes I left them hanging. You know, I mean, I would put out a thread and then forget about it. You know, it's like, and then people would come along and pick it up 10 years later and turn it into a miniseries. But often what you're just doing is trying to get through this current week of writing assignments, and you put in throw out some breadcrumbs that you hope you'll pick up later. We weren't as organized back then, and partly it was because of the way that things were done. Partly it was because how we wanted to do them too. You know, we didn't want to plan. Some of us didn't want to plan that far ahead. Some of us wanted to discover the stories as we were writing them. I'm working on a miniseries for Marvel right now that is plotted out, you know, for 6 issues, and I know exactly where it's going to end, and I know how it's all going to go. And that's never how I worked when I worked on Spider-Man, you know, for Marvel, or how I worked on Justice League for DC. I would know that I was doing it.
Cool. Get Adam back.
Who dropped out there?
Jerry dropped out.
It was you. It was Jerry, not you. Okay. So sorry. How many more you got there, Keith?
I can switch to you guys anytime you want. So how about we just let him finish this and then.
Sure. I mean, we got.
Do we have you, Jerry?
Yeah, here I am.
Oh,
I
guess
we got cut off.
You were talking about. Yeah, you were talking about how.
Rating and yeah. The plot.
But that wasn't how you wrote when you were with.
Yeah, we really didn't. We just plotted this. We plotted from issue to issue. We might have a general sense of where we wanted to go, you know, over the midterm, but we didn't have a sense necessarily of structuring things out for a year or two in advance.
And very few crossovers at the time, too.
Yeah, very few. And they were mostly, they were mostly one-sided in one sense. You know, you might do a story where you bring in a character from another book, but you wouldn't necessarily expect that would crossover into the other book. All of that really changed once they started doing these annual events, which were publishing decisions rather than creative decisions.
All right. Well, I've been monopolizing, so I'm going to hand things over to Brett.
All right.
And take it away, Brett.
So Steel.
Yes,
talk more about Steel the Indestructible Man.
Yeah, that's right. So I mean, you got your start really early. What your first published work was when you were 16?
I sold my first comic book story when I was 16. I think it came out. My first story might have come out before I was 17. Yeah, so yeah, pretty early.
So how easy / hard was it then to break into comic books at that time?
Well, I can only speak for myself. I had a lot of advantages. You know, there's kind of this national conversation going on now about white privilege. You know, I had the New Yorker privilege of living in New York, which gave me access to the comic book companies in a way that people who didn't live in New York didn't have access. And back then, we're talking about the mid to late 60s, DC offered a tour every Thursday during the summer for anybody who lived in the New York area. And I went on this tour the summer I was 14 or 15. Probably 14. I went every week on the tour and then separated off from the tour group and went and hung out with the different editors and asked them for work. You know, I was trying to sell myself as an artist initially, and they suggested that I try writing. So I was pitching ideas to different editors and during the school year. So I guess when I was a freshman or a sophomore in high school, I would go in the afternoon and try to sell story ideas to the editors after school. And I just did this for about couple of years. And so, you know, it wasn't easy, but it wasn't particularly hard either because I had the access, you know, of living in the city. And for some reason, these guys were open to those of us who were willing to keep banging our heads on the door. It's much harder now because you can't just wander in anymore. You can't bang on that door. But in certain ways, it's easier because you can create your own material now through web series and, you know, web comics and meeting people at conventions and creating portfolios and creating your own material. So it's really hard to compare the two. It's a different universe. It's a totally different universe than it was back then. Both more open and less open.
So, yeah, I mean, if you were, say, you were 16 right now and just wanting to start out, would you be creating your own comic book at this point? Just your own characters?
I think so. I think that's what you would be doing now. I mean, that's what I would be doing probably. You know, I'd be hooking up with an artist. You know, we'd be creating our own web comics. We'd be, you know, publishing it on the internet and probably trying to start our own punk company. I don't really know. I would not even begin to know how to recommend to someone to get into writing comics today, because it's a totally different business. I mean, I'm somebody who has connections, right, because of my history in comics. And even so, it's incredibly difficult for someone like me to get a project off the ground at one of the major companies. So I wouldn't even know how somebody would get off the ground at one of the companies. I think you'd have to start out by creating your own material, gaining some kind of reputation, you know, in the independent press or the independent comics or web comics, and then leapfrogging into the business that way. But you know, it's a whole new world, guys. I could only tell you how to do it in 1966, which is absolutely useless in 2014.
Unless we can find Dr. Doom's
time machine. Yeah, time right. Machine, yeah. We can go back in time. We can change everything.
So how then did you get the new Spider-Man miniseries that you're doing?
It came about because I had dinner with Joe Quesada. And he was like, oh, so, you know, you interested in doing anything for us? And I was like, yeah, sure. And a year later, you know, after a lot of conversations, a lot of, you know, back and forth, you know, finally get a go ahead to do something. And that's, you know, with kind of a privileged situation because I'm, quote, Jerry Conway. You know, I mean, I've got a history with Marvel and they kind of wanted it. They were already open to the idea, but it still took a year, you know, of back and forth and knocking on the door and, you know, talking about this, talking about that. And it's not easy, you know. I mean, there's a lot of gatekeeping that gets done, justifiably, because, you know, they have million-dollar properties now. Back when I was doing it, it was not that big a deal, you know. I mean, we were publishing comics that had a probably a larger audience in one sense, but a smaller impact. You know, being hired to write a comic book for Marvel in 1970 was a lot easier than being hired to write a comic for Marvel in 2014, because Marvel was a much smaller company, and the impact of any given issue was much less important. You know, they could take a risk on a 17-year-old or an 18-year-old back then, because it just didn't matter. I mean, I'm not reducing I'm not denigrating the importance of it for us as readers or fans back then, but seriously, Marvel was not as important a company as it is today. You know, today, millions of dollars ride on any given story that gets done for Marvel. Back in 1970, you know, it was worth maybe a couple of grand to them, you know. That was about it. And they figured the company was going to go out of business in a few years anyway, so what the hell. Hard to believe, but there
it was. And it didn't happen until about 1996.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, Marvel went out of business, you know, in one sense, you know, because business people wanted it to go out of business so they could sell it and make more money. it never went out of business because it was an unviable company. It went out of business because there were business reasons to do that. But back in the early 70s, it could have gone out of business because it wasn't a viable company. You know, the market for comics was evaporating in the 70s. It's amazing that it actually kept going. And I think it kept going for reasons that from a business point of view, didn't really make much sense. You know, but it did keep going, and thank God, because it finally caught a wave, and that wave, you know, has brought it to the cultural importance that it has today.
So is your new miniseries in continuity?
Yes, it is, and it's sort of in continuity, and it affects things that are going to happen in the Spider-Man books in the future, but it's sort of set to the side a little bit. If you don't read it, it will actually affect your appreciation of what's going on, because it does change things, you know. But if you don't read it, you won't necessarily know that you didn't, that you missed it, because it's not, you know, a numbered series. It's going to be a point. I think they're going to do it as a point series, you know, like.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. But it is going to have an impact on the main series, in ways that I am not at liberty to discuss.
All right. I knew this was going to happen. Mo is vibrating right now because he has a question. So okay. I'm going to give him a question and then I'll go back.
No. If you pass to me, it's done.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
I have a quick question.
I'm just vibrating because I want. I
Can I get in a quick question then?
Okay. All right, Keith, go ahead.
So, Jerry, just as you say that, Jerry, having read Marvel: The Untold Story. They talked very specifically about the late 70s, that sense that the comics could just fold up any day. How many times have you seen comics about to fold up in the time that you've been writing?
Well, I think when I came into the business, those of us who were in the business in the late 60s, early 70s, honestly thought that it was going to go away within 5 to 10 years. Because it just did not seem like there was a way for this to continue. I mean, in 1968-69, the average issue of Superman was selling 800,000-900,000 copies a month. You know, Spider-Man was selling 400,000 to 500,000 copies a month. 2 years later, Superman was selling 600,000 copies a month. 3 years later, Superman was selling 400,000 copies a month. Spider-Man was selling 250,000 copies a month. I mean, the handwriting was on the wall. This was going downhill. You know, every time you looked at a book, you know, you were looking at titles that had been selling a couple of 200,000 copies were now selling 150. And by the end of the 70s, these books were selling many, many fewer copies. You know, these days, you know, with the high cover price, you know, it's really hard to know what is considered a successful book anymore. I mean, a lot of comic books sell under 50,000 copies, under 20,000 copies. I did a miniseries for DC back. It must be 7 years ago. I mean, a series called Animal Man, you know, the Last Days of Animal Man.
Yeah.
And I don't think the thing broke 10,000 copies, you know, 10,000-12,000 copies. And I was like really embarrassed, you know, they didn't ask me back, but you know, that is not an unusual sales figure for a comic book these days. But back in the early 70s, we were seriously looking at the business going under because there didn't seem to be a path. You know, I mean, there didn't seem to be, you know, every month comics were selling less. So, you know.
And you're selling them for a quarter, so I can't imagine you're making that much.
Yeah, or 20 cents. Yeah. When I first started writing comics, they were selling for 12 cents, you know, an issue, or 12 to 15 cents an issue.
Imagine that, kids.
Yeah, kids. But they were selling 500,000 copies. So it's about the same. I mean, you know, it's weird. I mean, I was talking to somebody recently that my first paycheck on a comic book was for a story that I was paid $10 a page. But these days, you know, writers aren't getting that much, you know, much more over, you know, $120, $130 a page. And that's 40 years later, 40, 50 years later. It's still about $10 a page, you know, in real numbers. So what's different now is that you might get a royalty on these sales, but it's still it's not that huge a difference. But economically, the books are selling for much more, but they're not selling to a larger audience. So it's very strange. I don't understand the economics on it anymore. You know, I really don't. But nobody ever did. It was always marginal. The big difference now is that what happens in these books can be resourced out to a much larger audience through film and television. And that's where the money for the comic book companies really exists. I mean, the comic book companies are subsidiaries of much larger entities now. That wasn't the case in 1970, even though Marvel was owned by Magazine Management, which was a larger company. That still was not a very large company, and DC was owned by Warner Brothers, you know, in the mid-70s, but it was a very tiny entity within that larger company, and it didn't have any real impact on that larger company. Still doesn't, you know, today as a publishing entity. It's all very strange. I mean, I don't pretend to understand it anymore. I mean, I thought I understood it in the 60s and 70s, so I don't pretend to understand it now.
So you created a lot of, co-created a lot of characters. Now, yes. Back in those days, was there kind of, like, especially with the impending doom of the comic industry all the time, was there kind of a thought of, like, I'm just going to create for Marvel and DC and just throw whatever I can against the wall and hope something, you know, sticks and keeps going?
Well, yeah, in one sense, but we also didn't think that it had any real impact beyond, you know, the comics. You know, I created characters month after month after month at Marvel that are now iconic characters. But at the time, I was just trying to have a story that you know, would sell a comic book. I didn't think that it was going to go any further than that. You know, creating the Punisher as I did in 73, I mean, that didn't have any potential for outside of comics. You know, none of us saw that as a potential for anything other than, you know, a character that we could write another story about 2 months later, you know, or 4 months later. The idea that it might end up having movies made out of him just is ludicrous. You know, that was not part of the plan. We just wanted to create something that we could maybe, you know, riff on again, you know, a few months down the line.
So in I think it was 1972, you did an unofficial crossover with DC.
Yeah.
That you worked with Len Wein and Steve Englehart on.
Yes. Yeah, we did it. We did an unofficial JLA Thor Avengers crossover.
Now,
it involved a cat.
Catwoman was huge in it. Yeah,
very, very big. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was just for fun for ourselves, but it was not intended for anything other than, you know, the handful of readers who happened to notice that these stories are kind of intertwined.
At the time, was that kind of like sneaking something under the radar? I mean, can't imagine you being able to get away with that now, even.
Yeah, well, we were all a bunch of kids, you know, and we were all kind of unsupervised, you know, to some extent. I mean, more so at Marvel than at DC. I think when Julie Schwartz found out that I think it was Mike Friedrich who did it at DC and JLA. And when he found out that there was some kind of coordination going on, he was horrified. At Marvel, it was even looser because we didn't have a strict editorial supervision that you did at DC, where you were working with directly with an editor. Marvel, you had Roy Thomas as the editor in chief, but Roy wasn't really directly hands-on in the way that Julie was. So it was much more unsupervised and kind of kids doing something on their own, you know, without really being seen.
So you spent, you spent about a month as the editor-in-chief?
Yeah, about a month to 6 weeks, I think.
What drove you away from that?
It was a chaotic situation. Marvel had expanded from doing 10 or 12 books a month to 40, 50 titles a month, but without expanding its editorial staff, and without expanding its philosophy, its editorial philosophy, from writers sort of doing what they wanted to do from month to month. And as a result, you know, there wasn't really much supervision. As I say, we did these stories, you know, these crossover stories without people really being having much awareness of what we were doing. But that was when you were doing 10, 12 titles a month. When you're doing 50 titles a month and more, it becomes a much more problematic situation. And I came in, I was also 23 years old. And if that, you know, I was 22, 23 years old, and I was handed 50 titles a month to supervise. And I was working with some very strong personalities, all of whom felt that they should be in charge of their own material. And without having a lot of responsibility over the material that they were doing. I mean, they were working, there were so many issues here. I mean, they were very strong creative personalities without a lot of responsibility to the publishing end of things. So you ended up with writers who and artists working at cross purposes to each other. It's really hard to explain looking back 40 years, but it was just not a situation that lent itself to a management style that I had. You know, I mean, I didn't have a management style. I was 23 years old. You know, I mean, it was not a good situation. By the way, I'm also kind of burning out at this moment. You know, I mean, we've been talking for about an hour.
Okay, then.
I'm kind of winding down.
I had that sense. It's too bad. Hopefully, we'll be able to talk to you again in the future, because I wanted to try something where I just threw something for you. Can I ask you for one final story then? And
sure.
I'm looking for a story, something funny, something.
Oh God. I had something.
maybe, for instance, first ever time you met Stanley, what happened? What was that like?
It was very intimidating. I think I was about 17, 18 years old, and looking to write something for Marvel. And there was a process where you had to take what was known as a writing test. And what that was is you would get a 4 or 5 pages or 6 pages of artwork that had already been drawn, and you were asked to dialogue it, write some dialogue for it. And I think I wrote, I think it was for Captain America, something that Stan had already done. And Roy gave me these 5 or 6 pages, and I took them home, and I wrote some dialogue for them. And it was given to Stan to read. And Stan read it, and I think he was kind of, you know, looking for something more than what I was doing. And he was kind of, I don't know, you know, the kids, yeah, it's okay, you know. And I said, but it's really kind of good for, you know, I mean, the guy is only 17 years old, you know, I mean, I think it's pretty good. You know, he writes pretty well for a 17-year-old. And Stan said, well, can't we get a guy who writes really well for a 25-year-old? And I was like, Stan doesn't like my stuff.
Kicked in the nuts, isn't it?
Well, but, you know, he had a point. You know, I mean, I was very inexperienced. But he also was kind of open to talking to me, you know, and working with me. And Roy was really trying to find a way to get me in there. So Stan, at that point, this was just after Jack had left Fantastic Four. And Stan was looking to have these, to have somebody work on these titles, and plot these books. But he didn't, you know, necessarily want to plot them himself. So he asked Roy, could he find somebody who could maybe write a plot for him? And, again, you know, Roy brought me in, and this was my first meeting with Stan. And Stan wanted me to come up with a plot for an issue of Fantastic Four, based on something that he had in mind. So he told me the story, you know, very generally, and I went back and I wrote up the plot. And on the basis of that, you know, he decided I was okay. But I never got my name on that story, and it was, but that's fine. You know, I got paid $25 for the plot. And that was my first actual work for Stan. So, I was very intimidated meeting Stan Lee. I mean, the guy was my hero. But again, as I say, his first reaction to me was, hey, he's okay. You know,
the kid hasn't had a future 46 years later.
Yeah. Well, but oddly enough, a year and a half later, he let me write Spider-Man. So
yeah.
What are you going to do about that? Yeah. I give the guy credit.
Awesome. Anyway. Thank you, sir. That's kind of, I hope in the future, I'd love to talk Atari Force.
Oh, sure.
Love to talk Atari Force. Love to talk Law and Order Criminal Intent. Love to talk some more JLA. I mean, you obviously, I don't know if you're aware of this, you've had a long career.
It's been around. I've been around. But
I'd love to talk Diagnosis of Murder. I think you wrote 3 episodes of Matlock. I mean, how the hell can we not talk that?
Well, I've written a lot of shows that people's mothers loved. So I was... That's what
so
I did.
Absolutely. Hopefully, you'll be kind enough to give us your time again today, but we're going to go out. We're OUT then on this episode ourselves. We'll let you have the final say in this. Want to thank our sponsor, Comicosity, and Matt Centauri Griffin for setting this. Griffith, I did it again.
Yep.
I always do it every time. Quick edit, Brett. And one more time for setting this up. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. Thanks. I'm sorry I can't keep talking, but I am burned out.
That's awesome. Thank you so much.
Well, next time we'll get you when your air conditioner is working.
Yeah, that would help because I'm sweating a lot. That's
all I can say. Science fiction novels, that'll give me time to read them.
Yeah.
And then next time we'll talk.
All right.
Let's get you back.
Thanks a lot, guys.
About the time your Spider-Man's coming out, and we can talk about Steel, the Indestructible Man #2.
Okay. Thanks. All right. Take care, guys.
Jerry Conway, thank you very much.
Thank you.